From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm Jenna Gibson. This week's episode is a rebroadcast from the end of 2015, but has actually since then become one of our most popular episodes of all time. Those of you who are interested in econ may have already listened to this episode, but I think you'll really find some interesting insights about Korea's economic growth and also its economic ties to the United States. The guest for this episode was Tom Byrne, who is the president of the Korea Society in New York City. And before that, he was with Moody's Investor Services. So he has a lot of really great insights into Korea's economy over time. Please enjoy this rebroadcast episode, and we'll be back with a new one next week.
Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Kyle Ferrier, Director of Academic Affairs and Research at KEI, and I will be your guest host today. With me is Tom Byrne, President of the Korea Society and former Senior Vice President in the Sovereign Risk Group at Moody's. In this episode, Tom and I discuss how financial crises over the past two decades have shaped the Korean economy and the outlook for the future economic stability in Korea. Thank you for joining me today, Tom.
Thank you for the invitation.
Before we start our discussion on the Korean economy, I wanted to briefly ask you about your recent career change, having recently left Moody's to become the new president of the Korea Society in New York. What made you want to take on this new challenge, and how are you hoping to integrate your strong economic background more into the Korea Society's work?
Right. Well, it is a new challenge, but it's not a completely new experience for me. At Moody's, when I worked in the Singapore office and also in the New York office, and even before that, when I was the senior economist at the Institute of International Finance in Washington, D.C., I worked extensively on Korea's economy. So over the years, since the 1990s, I've been able to witness the evolution of Korea's policy framework, as well as, I think it's accurate to say, the economic advancement that Korea has demonstrated. And then before that, I was literally on the front line of Korea's early stages in economic development in the late 1970s when I served as a Peace Corps volunteer in the countryside of Korea. Of course, back then, K-pop wasn't wildly popular, but it seems that no day went by without hearing the Saemal Nori, or the Saemal Movement song. So I think it was my understanding of Korean culture and modern history that attracted me to this position. I also have to say it's a very exciting challenge because the Korea Society, I believe, has a good brand. And I'm working with very supportive stakeholders, namely the board of directors, as well as the Korean government and the staff as well. Other persons in the United States and academic and business community are also supportive of the Korea Society. So it's a very appealing challenge, actually. And yes, the board of directors selected me as a new president to build on and raise the profile of the Korea Society and its core program areas. Now, this includes work in education and culture, but also in the public policy area. And what I'll do in the upcoming years is sharpen the focus on economic and financial and business interests that Korea and the U.S. have together. I think this will help better fulfill the Korea Society's mission, which is ultimately to strengthen the ties between the people of the two countries. And we do that by promoting greater awareness, cooperation, and understanding. We would also like to have the Korea Society serve as a premier platform for discussions on policy, security, financial, and economic interest, issues of interest to the two countries, in addition to our work in education and culture.
Now, during your time at Moody's, Korea experienced two major financial crises. As you mentioned, the first being, and most damaging, being the Asian financial crisis. What were the key structural features of the Korean economy leading up to the market crash in November of 97, and why was Korea vulnerable to contagion at the time?
Yeah, I think, well, to put it simply, as you said, the 97 Asian crisis was a lot more severe for Korea, a lot more wrenching to the adjustment, the ensuing adjustment, than the 2008 global or transatlantic crisis. looking back at the 97-98 Asian financial crisis, and in Korea, there was a sense of complacency, I think, on the part of policymakers, as well as in the business community. And complacency led to a debt-fueled business expansion and a reliance on external funding to help finance this corporate expansion and the current account deficit at the time. That was the hallmark feature. We've had at the IIF, the former managing director, Charles Dallara, he gave a talk at Dr. Salgong Il's Institute in 1995. And he notes that one of the lessons for South Korea, as well as other emerging markets, that it cannot take for granted that the world will be enthralled by their economic and financial strengths and the opportunities. And one of the lessons is that complacency on the part of policymakers and business leaders comes at a dear cost. That was almost 2 years before the financial crisis. Other experts, such as you, Patrick, also speaking at Dr. Salgong Il's Institute, and that was shortly before the crisis, noted that Korea's financial system, like Japan's, lacked strong regulation and adequate risk management on the part of the financial institutions.
Now you mention significant risks, and I think that a lot of that was addressed through IMF loans and IMF conditionalities, which were quite unpopular in Korea to a point where the Asian financial crisis is referred to the IMF crisis in Korea. What have been some of the most lasting impacts on the structure of the Korean economy as a result of these programs in the immediate aftermath of the crisis?
Right. Well, first of all, I think it's important to recognize that it was the fundamental weaknesses that had built up in the Korean economy before the 97 crisis that set the stage for the crisis. It was not just a simple case of financial panic alone. And so therefore, I think there was a role for the IMF and its very broad spectrum medicine that it dished out to Korea. The IMF World Bank financing package was exceptionally large, $35 billion from those two institutions. I think the ADB could be included in that. And then a second line of defense that put it up to $58 billion. But the policies prescribed by the IMF to Korea when the program was first introduced were exceptionally tough. It was shock therapy. The most, I think, severe part was the call for tighter monetary policy. And so the Bank of Korea increased its call rate from 12.3% on the 1st of December 1997 to 30.1% at the end of that month. Market rates rose even higher. However, the policy didn't have its intended effect, and that was to stabilize the Korean won, because the Korean won over the same period through the month of December fell from 1,150 to the dollar to almost 2,000 to the dollar. Also, there were complications from this treatment unforeseen by the IMF, in that the IMF thought that the Korean economy would continue to grow, albeit very modestly at 1% in 1998. But by January 1998, bankruptcies had risen three times their pre-crisis levels. So the effects on the real economy were quite severe. The IMF revised its policies. The Bank of Korea started to cut its interest rates early in 1998, but a lot of damage was already done. If there was one silver lining in this very severe shock therapy package, was that the foreign banks did restructure their credits to the Korean banks. They were pulling out, they were cutting their lines at a fairly rapid rate, and the Bank of Korea was running out of foreign exchange reserves in November. That perhaps, looking back, arguably should have been achieved sooner. But the banks restructured their loans in early 1998, and at that time, the exchange rate stabilized, and also the stock market started to pick up and recover. So the IMF's initial policies were harsh. It backed off and became more accommodating to Korea. But this is, we should note that these are policies that neither the IMF or any government would ever adopt in a time of financial crisis, as we see now, particularly with the policies of the Fed, the Bank of Japan, and the ECB, and the low interest rate policy following the 2008 global financial crisis.
Now, you do mention the global financial crisis, which was the next major crisis to hit Korea after smaller credit booms and busts in 2001 and 2003. Right. But the scale of the impact on the Korean economy from the global financial crisis was much less comparatively to other advanced economies. To what extent do you think can this be attributed to internal or external factors?
Right. Well, What Korea demonstrated after the 97 crisis, a remarkable macroeconomic bounce back, resiliency, a hackneyed phrase, but it certainly was a case in Korea where growth contracted in 1998 by, I believe, 5.8% real GDP growth, and then bounced back something like 9%, if I have that number right. However, the structural adjustments took longer, and I think the weaknesses in the structural adjustments probably contributed to some of the tense moments in 2008, namely risk management on the part of commercial banks, leverage, reliance on external debt. These had been moderated and controlled to some extent, but not thoroughly, I think. And so going into the 2008 crisis, it's true that Korea did face the loss of foreign exchange reserves. However, it had a fairly substantial buffer before that. And so the buffer that the Bank of Korea built up allowed a high degree of self-insurance, but not a total degree of self-insurance. Now, these were exceptional times because the entire global dollar market, offshore market, had frozen up. So, you know, the Bank of Korea built up its reserves. Of course, inflation targeting had started. And inflation targeting is good for in a number of ways. One, it helps promote credibility in Bank of Korea policies. And also, I think low inflation helps protect the exchange rate as well as macroeconomic stability. So these are positive features in the Bank of Korea's inflation targeting. But the attention on financial stability wasn't really fully fleshed out until after the 2008 crisis. And implicit in that was Korea still had to develop its long-term capital markets. This was a shortfall. After the 97 crisis, this really hadn't happened. And after the 97 crisis, we know that there was the Daewoo crisis, the corporate bond crisis, the investment and trust company crisis in 1999, 2 years after the crisis. So the inflation targeting, which also helps promote the formation of long-term capital markets because it extends the investment horizon for investors, having that stable inflation and therefore stable benchmarks, interest rate benchmarks, wasn't fully in place. I believe it was in 2011 that the Bank of Korea started its financial stability reporting. And so I think the sense of complacency is gone and replaced by a sense of vigilance. And where we see this most concretely after 2008, I think, is the increased external buffer that Korea has and also improved risk management and improved structure of the commercial banks. So now Korea has two lines of defenses, as you will, the external position of the country, primarily embodied through the foreign exchange reserves of Korea, which are at an historical high or at, bouncing around an historical high, and also the improved position of Korean banks. If I can say one more thing about, a very notable thing about the external cushion that, that Korea has. Korea now has a, when you look at its external balance sheet, the assets and liabilities of the whole system, the Bank of Korea, the government, the banks, the corporations, individuals. Korea now has a sizable net asset position. This was not the case at the time of the global financial crisis. At the time of the global financial crisis, it had a net liability position of $214 billion, U.S. dollars. Now, in the most recent data, in September 2015, the $214 billion was September 2007. So by September 2015, that had swung in a positive direction by more than $400 billion. It's now 192% of GDP, which is something close to 10% of GDP for Korea. So that's a really big cushion. Turning to the banks have contained their short-term borrowing, but they've also improved their capital adequacy. They've also improved their liquidity. So the banks are in a pretty good shape to also serve as a buffer to either domestic or external financial shocks.
So you do mention a lot of foreign exchange buffers and external buffers for the Korean economy. And during the crisis 2008 to 2009, Korea had arranged a swap agreement with the Fed, but that has now expired, as well as an agreement with Japan. If another crisis were to hit, how has the regional financial architecture changed, and what type of financial safety nets are in place today?
Right. Well, first of all, it's a self-insurance. Korea has a bigger self-insurance policy, as I mentioned before, with the not just the official international reserves of the Bank of Korea at an historical high, but also the net international investment position being in a net asset situation. In addition to being self-insured, the countries in the region formed a regional financial swap arrangement. It's an awkward acronym. It's called the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization. That's a mouthful. But Chiang Mai is a city in Thailand where there was an ADB meeting, and I think that's when this was first wheeled out. Actually, I was at that ADB meeting, and there were demonstrations against the ADB. As a footnote, I could say that one of the reasons that I think Korea did so well, when you look at the big picture after the 97 crisis, is that there was economic and political stability. Koreans basically tightened their belt and went along with the adjustments that had to be made, as painful as they were, as we saw with rising unemployment, et cetera, all the bankruptcies. Okay, so getting back to the CMIM. So this was set up some years ago, and then in July 2014, it was doubled. So the total pool is $240 billion, and there's a chunk of that that's delinked from IMF programs. It's now 30% under some conditions, and strictures can be drawn. Now, Korea is one of the top contributors to this. China and Japan are the other two top contributors. So Korea, in an external liquidity crisis, can withdraw what it has pledged in, one times the amount. Japan and China, only half of what they pledged in. Other countries can pull more. I guess Indonesia is probably 2.5. And countries like Vietnam can pull out five times of what they've contributed or pledged. However, in the case of Korea, it's only $38 billion, and 70% of that would be linked to an IMF program. So most likely, the Koreans would put into place their own policy framework without having to go to the IMF again. It's very politically, could be very delicate to have an IMF program in any country in East Asia, we see, after the experience in 97. So to some extent, there's that, but that will only work if the crisis is idiosyncratic to a country. If all these countries are in crisis because of a global crisis, then they'd all be contributing and borrowing. So I'm not sure what the net effect of that would be. So there's that. But other than that, the swap arrangements were temporary facilities. And I recall that Korea did not use either the yen or the renminbi swap arrangement. However, it did use the Fed swap arrangement. The Fed also had swap arrangements, unlimited ones, with the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of England. It had a swap arrangement with the Reserve Bank of Australia. And then I think three others with other countries, one in Singapore, Mexico, and one other emerging market economy. Korea did draw on that $30 billion facility. It helped stabilize the market, I believed. But they also terminated the drawings ahead of, it was a temporary program, before the program expired. So just like the 97 crisis lending from the IMF and World Bank, Korea repaid early or quickly stabilized enough so it didn't have to rely on external support for financial stability.
Now, in the headlines, there are great concerns that a Federal Reserve decision to increase interest rates could result in economic turmoil in emerging markets. Mm-hmm. Would Korea face significant exposure to problems in emerging markets from a rise in U.S. interest rates?
Well, it is an open economy, so, you know, an interest rate increase would be transmitted over to Korea. There could be some disturbances in capital flows. However, I think this is a risk that Korea is well positioned to manage, mainly for reasons I just went over. Also, what we've seen is that I think the KTB, the Korean Treasury bond yield, seems to be more closely correlated to the Bank of Korea's policy rate than U.S. Treasury rates. We see this most recently in recent months. And of course, we saw this following the global financial crisis. So Korea has a degree of, I think, of immunity. Also, the external borrowing that Korea does, particularly the Ministry of Finance, is denominated in Korean won. Now, external borrowing still means you have foreign creditors, and they may have a different risk profile. They may be facing their own challenges where they'd have to liquidate assets. But Korea's exposure to foreign creditors, the percent of debt held by foreigners, is relatively low. I believe it's about 14%. Whereas, say, the countries in Europe during the euro crisis that faced challenges, you'd see the non-resident holding a government debt easily more than 40%. In the case of Korea, it was 13% at the end of December 2014, according to the IMF. And this is a relatively low number. Japan, it's 8%. That's really low. So the vulnerability is reduced by relatively deep domestically funded government debt market as well.
Nearly half of Korean GDP is linked to the global economy via international trade, which is quite high for a country of its economic size. Given the increased frequency of financial crises, do you think Korea is overexposed to the global economy and would benefit from increased domestic demand?
Yes, of course, that's true with any economy, at least in theory. But let's not lose sight of the big picture. Integration of a country with the world economy through trade and investment is an important channel for the transfer of technology, skills, management. And it's also a powerful force for greater competition in local markets, which should make local corporations and banks stronger. And so what we see is a positive correlation between openness and above average rates of economic growth. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Also, you know, Korean corporations now are so big and dynamic, they just can't rely on the domestic market. They can serve a broader market than just the domestic market. Trade openness in Korea is large. It's about 95% of GDP, the sum of exports and goods and services. However, Germany's is also about the same size. It was about close to 90%, I estimate, at the end of 2015. The continental economies, such as the U.S. and China, the U.S. is about 30%. China and Japan are about 40%. So the reality is, even though Korea is a relatively large market compared to the U.S., it is a small open economy. So there's pluses and minuses with that. But over the long run, I think there are more pluses than short-term minuses.
So looking from possible external risks to domestic risks, household debt has been a significant concern for the Park Geun-hye administration. At the end of 2014, it was about 164% of disposable income. And to put this into perspective, this was about 140% in the U.S. in 2007. Have domestic factors now become the most significant risk to financial stability in Korea?
As a domestic factor, yes. However, I still think that the greatest economic risks to Korea are the slowdown in global demand, meaning the suboptimal growth in the United States, definitely in the European Union, also in Japan, and now the growth slowdown in China, which still has, I think, several years to run its full course. And that's if policies are right in China. So let's put Korea's household debt in perspective. You're right, as a share of disposable income, it is high, higher than the U.S. However, some of the other highly indebted systems in the world, in the OECD, let's put it that way, have had crises and others have not. You have, I believe, Portugal and Ireland that have higher household debt to disposable income ratios, but you also have Sweden, Canada, and Switzerland, which are relatively stable countries. Well, that's just putting in perspective. But a mitigating factor is that households have large financial assets that exceed their financial debt. And even though financial debt is on an upward trajectory, the upward trajectory of financial assets has even been slightly greater since 2012. So this is a cushion and a mitigating effect. Household debt, I believe, dampens the growth outlook for Korea in the sense that if you want domestic demand to drive the economy, households can't provide much of a lift there because they're relatively highly indebted. And with interest rates going up, the ability to households to spend more to support the economy without piling on more debt is also constrained. And then the Bank of Korea also cites it as a concern or a constraint on monetary policy. They've been consistently doing this in their statements for some time now.
So if another financial crisis were to hit Korea, what would be some of the institutional strengths of the current political and economic system to manage the severity of a downturn?
Right. Well, I think there's a lot more vigilance on the part of the policymakers, the Bank of Korea, the Ministry of Strategy and Finance, and also the regulators, the FSC and the FSS in particular. So they would be, I think, better positioned to implement corrective policies on a timely basis, I believe. Also, as I said before, the Bank of Korea has stronger cushions. The banks are in a better position. The corporates have deleveraged, but there are still weaknesses in the corporate sector. You know, back in 1997, the debt equity ratios in Korean corporations were over 400%. That's very high. Now, there's only two industries where the debt equity ratio is above 200%, and that's shipping and construction. However, with the downturn in the oil markets and global trade, shipbuilding debt to equity ratios are rising. They're not quite 200%, but they're rising rapidly. So, in addition to debt equity ratios, there's still a fair amount of corporations that have weak ability to service their debts, as witnessed by the interest coverage ratios, operating income over interest expenditure. It's still relatively high in Korea. So the corporate sector isn't restructuring is still lagging somewhat. This is highlighted by the Bank of Korea's financial stability surveys, which show that out of the six areas of risk, it's the corporate sector and the household sector, their indebtedness, pose the greatest risks to financial stability in Korea.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Tom. Very much looking forward to the work at the Korea Society in New York and working with you in the future.
Well, thank you. Likewise.
Tom would like to note that two papers by Korean economists published in the early 2000s offer a good assessment of the policy environment surrounding Korea's 1997 crisis and help to shape his comments today. The first is by Choi Gong-pil, entitled Post-Crisis Financial Developments in Korea, Implications for Monetary Policy. The second is by Lee Hyun-hoon, entitled The IMF Rescue Program in Korea, What Went Wrong? Thank you for joining us on Korean Context, and I hope you will join us again soon.